Thank you very much, Provost Anderson, for this kind and generous introduction. It is certainly a pleasure to be here. Can you hear me in the back? I have back problems, but it seems to affect my voice as well. But once I get into it, I'll speak louder and there'll be no problem. What happens with the... The purpose of this flashing the stars is to remind me to give credit for this title to Nancy Martin. I actually sent her last spring a title of the talk and an abstract, and she always claimed that she doesn't like math. So she ignored the title completely and read the abstract. And after reading the abstract, said, well, why don't you use this title? And I actually found the title very interesting. So this is Nancy's title. The talk is mine. So thank you, Nancy, for that. And speaking of credits, this talk is actually spanned several years of research, starting from 1992 until the current year. And this research has been done collaboratively with several people from the States and from Spain and other places. The first such article on this topic was published in 1992 in the Journal of the Royal Statistical Society, and it has, until last week, 401 citations. This is perhaps the largest citations in all my paper that I've written before. Thanks to Google Scholars, you can easily see how many people cite our. And then the last one is in press. It's about to be published perhaps in December, this coming December. I will summarize quickly in about 50 minutes or so what happened during these years. The outline of the talk is three main items. The first item will just simply talk about some jargon so that you know expression that you know exactly what do I mean by mentioning them. What's the data set, what's the word massive, and what's hyperdimensional. And then number two, I'll talk about the problem of outliers, the definition of outliers, and their effect on data analysis, and the reason for the presence of outliers in data. These two items will take perhaps about 10 minutes, no more, perhaps a little bit more, but not much. And then the main talk is actually about item number three, which I will talk about two methods for dealing with this huge data in terms of the number of observations and also in terms of dimension. And these two methods would be either numerical or graphical, and I'll talk about one each of the talk. The first one here is a data set. When I say data set, I mean it's a collection of measurements of P variables or attributes on N observations or individual. Perhaps it is best explained by an example. If we are taking only one measurement on, let's say, 252 people, and that measurement is income, so I have only one variable, then if Bill Gates was included in the data set, Bill Gates and perhaps Professor Anderson will be outliers. I didn't say President Arnold, but by the time he moved to his new job, he will be an outlier. And as an example of a data set, you can think of it as a spreadsheet, you know, Excel file. The columns represent variables. So in this case here, I have P of them, X1 up to XP. And the rows, each one represent observations or an individual. So I have N of them, 1, 2, 3, up to N. So the first row here will be all these measurements are called one observation for the first individual, and the second row for the second individual, and so on. And then each column represents one measurement for all people, or all individuals, and so on. So the columns are variables, the rows are observations. The word data set means this table, if you wish. Massive data sets means that it's a very large or huge data set. We're talking here about the number of observations N. And when I say huge, we're talking here about not just simply thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, and perhaps million observations. And I'm going to use such data sets in some examples in today's talk. The word hyperdimensional, or perhaps high-dimensional, but mathematicians usually like the word hyper more than high. High-dimensional means a large number of variables or attributes, large P. So massive, hyper simply means huge data sets. I give you two examples of such data sets that we see in practice. The first one is the commercial flights. During commercial flights, they take about 200 measurements, like, for example, the outside air, the altitude, the accuracy, the speed, and so on and so forth. 200 measurements once every 8 seconds. So every 8 seconds, you have 200 measurements. So imagine that you are traveling from Cairo to New York, and at the end of the flight, you will have about a total of 69 million values for one flight only. So imagine if you have all the flights over 1 year, let us say, you can imagine the size of the data that we are talking about. The second example is the credit card. For example, if you are a bank issuing a credit card, you are interested in all the transactions that are done by all your card members during a year, let us say. This is another example of huge data set. So I guess you have an idea by these two examples when I say massive hyperdimensional or simply huge data set. If you put this on a computer, we're talking about files here that are measured not in megabytes or gigabytes, but actually in terabytes. So if you don't know what this terminology means, I don't know either, just simply huge, huge data sets. Okay? And these are common data sets, actually, with advancement in the computer technology, and the size of the data set has given rise to a new field of study called data mining. The second item is about outliers. What are the outliers? Are just simply a group of observation. Usually it's a minority of the data. If they are the majorities, this means that the others are the outliers. So it has to be a minority of observation that do not follow the pattern suggested by all other observations in the data set. So the definition of outlier is a relative. So related to other points in the data. So in my previous example, Bill Gates will be an outlier because his income does not follow the pattern suggested by my income and your income here, excluding Professor Anderson. Okay? Another example, which is a real data here, very, very tiny, small, but later on I'll give you a much larger data set here, is that we have 47 stars, and on each star we have two measurements, the light on the surface of the star and the temperature of the star. And we have two variables here, p equal to 2 and n equal to 47. Out of these 47, there are four data points, four stars are known as the giant stars, and these are the outliers here, as you can see in the upper left corner. Suppose that you want to study the relationship between light and the temperature. So in elementary statistics, we try to fit a regression line to the data. So what is the best line that represents these data points? If you do that, you'll find that negatively sloped line. This is a least squares regression line. And if you are not careful enough, you will jump and say, I have new discovery, that is the light and the temperature are negatively related. Well, you don't need to be a physicist to know that this is not true. Light and the temperature should be positively related. A more careful look at the data is to set aside the outliers temporarily. So if you wish, delete these outliers. This is not what I recommend you do in practice, but for the purpose of illustration here, if you set aside these four giant stars, which actually do not belong to the usual stars, and try to do the exercise again by fitting the regression line, the best line that fits this data, you would actually have this positively sloped line. The two lines, as you can see, are almost perpendicular to each other. which means that they are exactly diametrical. Give you the diametrical conclusion. The first line will tell you that the two variables are negatively related and the other one are positively related. So this shows you the effect of outliers. If they exist in your beta, they can have tremendous impact on the analysis and on the conclusions that you draw from the analysis. Now, another example is the September 11 disaster. One of the hijacked planes on that day had 80 passengers. Five of these passengers have the following unusual characteristics. One, they purchased tickets at the last minute. Two, they purchased one-way instead of a two-way ticket. Three, they pay for their tickets in cash, not in credit cards. Four, they did not check in any luggage. And five, they were little from the same country. I'm sure if people look at the data while the flight, all this data, by the way, are available before the takeoff of the flight, even an automatic computer program that will check the data for outliers would discover that these are unusual passengers, and maybe the whole disaster could have been avoided had we do that. We do that now, but not beforehand. So these five people out of 80 are clear outliers. They do not follow the pattern suggested by the rest of the people on the flight. Okay? I guess now the idea of outliers is clear. I didn't clearer, not clear. I can only make things clearer. Okay? Why outliers are there or observed in real data sets? There are so many reasons for them. They may represent fraud activities in medical practice, for example, doctors who charge a lot more money than other doctors because you have an insurance and you're not paying for it, so let me charge you more. Fraud in insurance claims, and we have people here from the insurance industry who know this very well. Violations of safety and security conditions, for example, if you look at the surveillance cameras and you see something happen unusual, that could be an outlier, or simply criminal behavior. So many reasons. They may represent intrusion or hacking or attacks on computer systems. People in computer science would appreciate this very well. They may represent conditions prone to immediate or future failure, such as the airplane crashing or hijacking or production line failure. So if you observe these and you detect them in enough time, you could at least mitigate the effect of the disaster. Maybe you can eliminate it entirely. And then finally, they may also be simply errors in data. Instead of 19, you write 91. Or encoding the data, you make such errors. So outliers could be errors, they could be not errors through data points. So to conclude these two items in the agenda, that outliers are commonly found in data sets. In my own experience, I almost never seen a real data set without outliers. Outliers can drastically affect the results of the analysis, as you can see from the STARS data. Identification of outliers improve the data quality and the reliability, and hence the quality of the decision drawn from the data. Obviously, the quality of your decision can never exceed the quality of your data. So if you start with a low quality data, your decisions will be even lower, can never be higher. And therefore, it is very important for data analysts, which you people, very important to be able to identify outliers. I jumped ahead here. I don't know what happened. So how do you, let me go back, sorry. I shouldn't hold this in my hand. This, when I'm nervous, I tend to push things. So now you know that I'm nervous. I finished the two items in the agenda, and I think I talked about 10 minutes, maybe 15 minutes, as I said. So, therefore, the important item here is how do we actually find the outliers? You saw the bottom line here in that. Well, there is an outlier detection machine that you might see it in Khan Khalili, but you probably did not recognize it, but here is the one. Okay, you buy one, you put the data on the top, and this machine will tell you, okay, here are the outliers and these are the good data. That's easy. So, unfortunately, this machine does not exist until the moment that I'm talking with you now. Right? All the efforts that have been done so far is just to come as close as possible to this real machine of detecting outliers, because the problem actually is very difficult. And you will see why in a second. Right. So we start to say, like, if we have few dimensions, okay, three or more or less, one, two, or three dimensions, keep it one, two, or three, you can actually use graphical methods to detect outliers. And these are very effective because you can see it, and the human eyes are the best outlier detector if you can see the data. But the problem becomes if you can't see the data, then what can we do? So if you have three or less variables, you can look at one-dimensional graph for each variable, or two-dimensional graphs like scatter plots, or three-dimensional graph like rotating plot here. And let me give you an example. A data set that I have here is called the body fat data, and it is used for fitting the percentage of body fat to many other body measurements. For example, like the weight and the height, the size of your hips, and so on and so forth. This is a small, very small data set by the standard I'm talking about today here, but I'm just simply using it for illustration, and then I'll jump later on to larger data set. We have 252 individuals. Each one of them will measure 16 characteristics, so we have 16 variables. So this is a very small data set, but I just simply use it to illustrate here. Go live here means I'll just go and use a program that I have written myself to just show you how you actually do it in practice, not just simply talk about it here. So I'll escape the PowerPoints for a second, and I'll go to one of the programs up over here. What you see here is that each of these folders is actually a data set that I use either for my teaching or for my research, so I collect them. So these are my collections, okay? A piece of art to me, so to speak. The first folder here is actually the fat data that I'm talking about. I shouldn't speak about this subject myself, but here I am. And to illustrate the point, it was just there are so many 16 variables here. Let us just take three of them. Okay, to illustrate the point here. Let's say, for example, the one that we are familiar with is age, weight, and the height. These are the three variables. We can take them one at a time, or two at a time, or all three of them together. So let me see here. These are, for example, if we take them one at a time, these are the three histograms, one for each of the variables that we have here. This is screen here is too big. Well, let's see. The first one is age. One bar here that you see represents the age of an 81-year-old man. These are all men, by the way. So the age ranges from 21 to 81. So we have one. I don't think this is an outlier, but it's very close to the rest of the data. Let me just close this to bring this to the side here so you can see it. Right. And here, this is the histogram of the weights. We have one person here. These are, by the way, in pounds. Okay, I was tempted to measure them in kilograms, but if I do that, Lisa and David might have difficulty to understand them. So I left them in pounds. Okay. So as you can see, we have one very fat person here, 360 pounds. Okay? This is far away from the rest of the people, so this is a clear outlier here. If you look at the height variables here, here is another outlier on the lower side here. That's the person who is 27 inches, and this is an adult, 41-year-old man. So this obviously, this is the height, so this obviously a midget. So we have at least one midget whose weight actually is higher than, relatively speaking, to his height. And also we have a fat if that person is there. So even one-dimensional graphs can give you an idea about what's going on in the data. But of course, this is not sufficient. Now, if you look at the variables two at a time, so I have three variables, we can look at the age versus the weight, the age versus the height, and the weight versus the height. So if I choose them like this here, and I go to the plot menu, and I say plot matrix, this will give me all of them simultaneously. So what do I have here? This here is the plot of the age versus, let me make it darker. Okay, so this is here the age versus the weight, the age versus the height, and this is the weight versus the height. So when you can see, what you can see here is that there's one person here, if you click next to it here, you see, it says this is a fat person. Okay, if you click here, this is the midget. And this is the same thing here. So perhaps it will help us if we color them. So I'm going to take the last one here, and I choose this person here and may give it the color, let us say red. Okay, this person here, and let us give it the color blue. My apologies if you are color blind. My son is, so I can't use this to teach my son anything here. So I have three here. So which one is this one here? This is the 81-year-old man, the oldest in the thing. So these are two-dimensional graphs. So can we go beyond that? Yes, we can. Let us try the three-dimensional graph, which means that we could take these three variables here, and then we'll go to the plot menu, and that graph is called rotating plot. Now, it's too small here, so let me just stretch it over the screen here. And it's still too small in the middle. I know you can't see this, but let me explain to you, and I'll make it larger for you in a second. This is the age here on the vertical dimension, and this here is the height on the horizontal dimension. And I just said this is a three-dimensional graph. This is not really a three-dimensional graph. It's only a two-dimensional graph. But let me just enlarge it a little bit here so you can see it here. One thing that you would notice is no surprise that the age and the height are independent, because we talk about adults here. Everybody is more than 21 years old, so the age and height are very much independent, unless you are really very old and you start to shrink. Okay, but no, the oldest one here is 81, so they are independent. Where is the third dimension? The third dimension is coming at you, but you will not be able to see it unless you rotate the graph. And there is a rotating tool here, which is this one here, and so I can start to rotate the graph and I make it look like this here. So when you rotate it like this, you can see the third dimension. So for example, if I rotate it carefully enough, I can see, well, there is a very nice linear trend here in three dimensions. Notice the two outliers, one is here and the other is here. The third outlier, which is not really outliers in three dimensions, this is the 81-year-old man. It fits very much well with the rest of the data. So you can look at this from this three-dimensional rotating graph. You can find the structure and the pattern. Of course, the disadvantage of this tool is that you can play with it. You can do it like this, you know, or even like this. Okay, but this is not the point. Okay? Very entertaining. Who said this mathematics is boring? Can't see? Okay. So let me go back to the PowerPoint slides and say that, well, if we have three or less dimension, the problem is very easy. Just look at the graph, the appropriate graph, and your eyes will be the outlier detection machine. The problem arises when we go more than three. We go four, five, or six, and so on. One thing that you should know, that the fact that we can't see higher dimensional spaces, four, five, six, up to any finite number of them, the fact that we can't see them does not mean they don't exist. No, they do exist. And the people who live in these spaces can tell you that, if you can meet them. But fortunately, we can actually, even though we can't see them, we can actually go in these high-dimensional space, and we look around either through numerical methods or through visualization of these higher-dimensional space. And that's the topic of today, how we actually go inside these dimensional spaces, because they do exist. We just simply can't see them, but they do exist. And we are able to go inside them and look around, for example, find the structures or find outliers. Okay? How am I doing? Thank you. I forgot my pain, but let's see what will happen at the end of the talk. Okay. So to go beyond three dimensions, some people say, well, all right, let us use, for example, some colors or sound or things like that, but these do not really add much. So we want to really to go into higher dimension, let's say 200 dimensional or 1,000 dimensional. And actually, if you can do it for 4, you can do it for 1,000. The difficulty is exactly the same. It doesn't get difficult as a dimension goes up. So I will talk about two different classes of methods that will allow us to go inside these spaces and look around. One is under the class of visualization method. Note here, I don't say graphing method. These are visualization, which means that the higher dimensions, we can't graph them. But maybe if we can reduce them to two-dimensional, three-dimensional, then we can look at them. What we look at is not the graph of the data, but we visualize data. So to speak, you close your eyes and look around, and you will see. So these are the visualization method, and my co-authors and I have come up with three different methods that can fall under this class of measures of visualization. Today I'll talk only about the first one of them. It's a very simple graph called the L1, L2 plot. But there are two other graphs that probably even better than the first one, but this is the easiest to explain here. This is the graph that is coming in December of this year. And the graph here has to be in color, and the provost was generous enough to pay for the graphs in the journal that we'll appear. So I'll talk only about one such graph. And the second class of methods is called the numerical method. These are not graphical, even though they will sometimes lead to some graphs, but these are numerical procedures. All of them, numerical or visualization, they are effective. Effective means they succeed in capturing the structure in higher dimension, and the computationally efficient means fast enough that sometimes you can execute in real time, even though you have a very large data set. So the first one is the visualization of data, which is the L1, L2 plot. Setting the mathematical technicalities aside, this is very important statement here, and I'm sure my friend Michel Hebert here will not be happy to hear it, but that's okay. Once I take him out for lunch, he'll be okay. We'll not talk technicalities here. The L1, L2 plot, what is it? It is a very simple two-dimensional projections of the higher dimensional space. So we take a p-dimensional space, we project it somehow into two dimensions, and we look at the two dimensions, hoping that we will see in two dimensions what is there in the higher dimensional space. Well, if you give a talk in mathematics, it will be a sin to give the entire talk without seeing any formulas. So I don't want to be sinful, so I'll just give you only two formulas in this talk. This is the L1 and the L2. What is the L1 and L2? They are projections. They are projections from higher dimensional to two-dimensional space. And you take the L1 and L2, you plot them, you do a scatter plot of L1 versus L2. And you would hope that this graph, well, it's actually more than hope, because in the paper we prove the properties of the graph, that what kind of structure that actually can detect, and so on and so forth. So there are some mathematical proof there in the paper, and also some simulation results using simulated data and using also real-life experiments. Okay. So to give you an example, I'm going to use three nested spheres data. What is that? Think that you have soccer ball, okay, in three dimensions. So soccer ball like this, right? And you put the soccer ball inside a larger soccer ball. And these two soccer balls, you put them inside a third, which is larger soccer ball. And around the surface of each of these soccer balls, you see the observations. And then there's gaps between each one of these balls. Imagine here, for example, in two dimension only, the sphere is a circle. In two dimension, you have two circles, one and three. And you can see it because it's a circle, two dimensions. But if you do one more dimension, three dimension, even when you rotate it, you will not be able to see the structure of the point unless you slide the balls this way. So we take the balls here because they are inside each other. You rotate them, no matter how you rotate them, you will not see that there are two other balls inside the big one that you see in the surface. So this is actually a very challenging problem. Once you go to the third dimension, because you will not be able to see it. And as I said, if you go to the third, if you know how to do the third, well, the fourth is the same thing as in any other dimension there. So once you go beyond the third dimension, it makes no difference actually, unless except for the computational time. But for the mathematical complexity, it's exactly the same. So we have these three nested spheres, right? That's a description of it. Okay, and the observations are scattered around the surface of each one of them. And we have the data, we don't have the spheres, but we constructed the data to have this feature here. And here I'm using p equal to 5 dimensions. So this five-dimensional space, still very low, but it makes no difference except for the computational time. And let us see if the L1, L2, among other methods, will be able to discover this nested structure in the data. I'm going to compare the L1, L2 to two other common well-known methods. They are also projection methods. They try to project the higher dimensional space into two-dimensional space. The first one is called the crystal component analysis. Second is Fisher linear discriminant analysis. Third is called multidimensional scaling. We don't know what these is. Each one of them is try to project the data from the p-dimensional space into two-dimensional space, in the hope that they will discover the structure of the data. So here are the four graphs for the nested spheres. This is for the principal component analysis. This is for the Fisher discriminant analysis. This is for the multidimensional scaling. Note that we are using the color here to represent the sphere because I know each sphere. So I have the three colors here. The three other methods fail miserably to detect the structure, but the L1 and L2, you can see clearly that there are three nested spheres in the data. And the size of the data set here is 500 points on each sphere. So I have 1,500 and p equal to 5. But as I said, if you increase it, whether in terms of the number of observations or the number of dimensions, the mathematics remain the same. It's only the computational time. So let's increase this a little bit more. N equal to 60,000 points. And p equal to 10, so this means 600,000 values that we have here. For this data set, multi-dimensional, you cannot produce the results at all because it requires a storage that is bigger than any computer, even supercomputer. So we have only three methods that are left here, and as you can see, we get exactly the same results here with L1, L2. You know that the density now of the points is very dense because this is much larger number of observations, 60,000 instead of 500 inside each of these spheres. The multidimensional scaling simply is too, the data is too big for that. Right. Now the second example is called the polling data. And this data set actually was offered by the American Statistical Association as a competition. So here is the data set. Discover the structure that they set and come present it at the meeting, the annual meeting of the American Statistical Society. The data set is available at this site here, the website. Again, it has p equal to 5 dimensions, and n is equal to 3,800 observations. So this is a small data set. The importance of this data set is the structure of the data. That's what's challenging. What is this data set is about? It has two different structures. One is linear structure, means a plane. And the other is nonlinear structure, which is elliptical. It's oval structure, but in 5 dimensions, not in 2. If you plot it in 1, 2, 3 dimensions, you will not see it either. Okay? And the challenge here, if you discover that structure. Of course, the people who created this data did not tell you about the structure, because it's computation. Here's the data, okay, 3,800 rows and p equal to 5 columns. Discover the structure of the data. So this is rather challenging because the plane is actually embedded inside the elliptical structure. So we apply the alternative method here. Here is the principal component again. The linear structure, you can see it in red because we know it after the fact, not before the fact. So I colored the linear structure in red here, so if it's not colored, you will not see it. Well, and here is it's actually a point, the linear structure, that you can't see it. Because again, the color is known after the fact. Before the fact, you don't know. All the data are alike. Fisher, the schema, that does not apply here because you need to know the class of each observation, so it is not appropriate in the LCS. So this left us with the L1, L2. Two things that you would notice here. One is that the class color denote all the linear structure appeared here. But also we have few of those, one over there and one over there and two over there. So these are our outliers. This here could also be considered an outlier because it's different than other points here. Now, actually, if you take this area here and you zoom it in, you enlarge it, right? This is what you get. Okay, this is Eureka. Okay, this is very clever, actually, that people construct this data set. So they put Eureka, which is plain, inside the elliptical structure in five dimensions. This is not just to the, in five dimensions. Okay, so as you can see, the L1, L2 discover that structure. Okay, that's the second example here. And go alive, time permitting. No, time does not permit me to go alive in this one here. So let's talk about the second one. If I have time later on, I'll come back to the go alive. The second class of methods is the numerical method. And I'll describe a method, one is called the Bacon method. That's the one that I started to work on since 1992 and then 94 to modify the method, and then 2000 to make it more efficient. Bacon is not the bacon that you are familiar with, okay? It's not bacon and eggs. Bacon stands for blocked, adaptive, computationally efficient, outlier nominated. I'm sure it's much easier to say bacon than to say this full thing here. And this is actually the title of the paper, and we chose the title so carefully that it will spell bacon to honor Sir Francis Bacon, who we believe that he is the first person to recognize the problem of outliers some 400 years ago, just before you were born. Okay, he gave a very interesting statement in this reference here. Notice computationally efficient is considered one word here, because if it's not one word, then it will not spell bacon. But actually, each one of the words has a meaning. It's not just simply, it has a meaning. Block, it has a meaning. Adaptive means it depends on the data, the performance, and so on. I will not go through this, but it's just simply bacon. It's numerical. Its purpose is to discover outliers if they exist in the data. Okay? Sorry, Michelle. One more time, I'm going to set the mathematical technicality aside. And I said Bacon consists of four simple steps. I'm going to start with a very small data set, subset of the data, a very small subset of the data that I believe to be free from outliers. Okay? And there is a way to find such a subset. And then see if I can enlarge the subset to include the other observations that are not there, but they are also good ones. They are not outliers. Enlarge it. That's step number two. And then look at the new subset and examine just in case if I put something there by mistake, so I have to take it out again back. And then four, repeat step number two and three until convergence. What do I mean by convergence? The subset no longer changes. Okay? So you put in, you take out, the same thing at the previous subset. At this last step, the convergence, you look at the basic subsets. All the observations that are not there, they are the outliers. Because remember, we start with the basic subset that are free from outlier, and we include only the observations that we think they are not outliers. So if the observation is not in the final basic subset, it is considered to be an outlier. I think that the best way is to illustrate this by example alive also. I start with p equal to 3 variables, and n is equal to 1 million observations, so getting larger and larger here. So in total, we have 3 million values that we look at. And the reason I'm choosing p equal to 3 here is that we can actually look at the rotating plot, so you can actually see it in action here. So that's 3 million observations, and you will see it in front of you alive, okay, using real time. Here, even if I don't have time, I must go to the live here. So let me go first with this one here. Here is the rotating plot for this data set at the first shot of it here. This is elliptical data, 1 million data in 3 dimensions. We see only 2 dimensions because I didn't rotate the data yet. But before I do the rotation here, let me just illustrate the Bacon program. So what I do here is that I will choose a small data set. So for example, I'm going to choose this data set here and I say this is the initial subset, very small. And I choose it in the middle. Why? Because usually outliers are toward the center of the data. The outliers outside, but the inliers, the good data are toward the center. So I choose it in the center, as you can see. So this is my first choice. There are automatic ways of selecting this subset. That's what I'm omitting here. So just do it this way here. And then we are going to do the steps here in the top here. So I'm going to click once to give me the first step. So that's the first step. All the observations elliptical near this subset are believed to be inliers. The other outside are outliers, but we didn't finish yet. We need to do more steps. So we did one step so far. And now the second step here, well, included almost all of them. And if I click more, click more, click more, it doesn't change. So this is the final thing here. So where are the outliers? Well, they are hidden. Okay, but this is two-dimensional, not three-dimensional. Once you start rotating here, so I'm going to use the rotation tool, and I move this way here. Here are the outliers. I purposely put them in the back there. And actually, I put them near the center, and some of them were chosen in the first initial subset. So you can see these are the outliers here, so you can see them from any direction here. Now, suppose I start with the wrong subset, not the right subset. So what is the worst possible thing that I can start with? The outliers themselves. So I'm going to start here, start from scratch, okay? And then I'm going to choose these outliers here, and I say this is the initial list that are free from outliers. Okay? And then I go and I click here for the first step. But before I do that, what do you think? Which observation will be included? Remember, outlier must be a minority. Okay, so this is not the majority of the data. The majority are there. So I have to add from this to this subset. Which ones will be included? The one closer to the outlier. So here is the first step here when I click on the first step. Here we go. Right? And this is 3 million values, remember. Okay, that's what we're talking about. So we need to click one more. Click one more. Well, what happens now? The outlier will pick down. Click one more. Click one more. No change. So we came up with the same result. This is called self-correcting property of this algorithm. And to give the credit, I'm not the one who discovered this property. I gave you the algorithm. And the guy from London School of Economics, by the name of Anthony Atkinson, is the one who discovered the self-correcting. So even if you start with the wrong foot, at the end, you will find the self-correcting. I'll give you one more illustration, because I still have a few minutes, Madam Provost. So let me start here by saying initial. And let me say that, well, another possible difficult situation is I choose a subset to be a mixture, okay? Both inlier and outlier this way, and see what happens here. So if I click, that's the first step. Okay, it's just obvious. Outlier is spinned out. One more time here, one more time finished. Okay. So as you can see, this is a very fast procedure, very effective in finding the structure, even if you start on this. Of course, the automatic choice of the subset, the initial subset, is chosen very carefully. That makes it almost very unlikely that we will start with a subset that includes outliers in there. All right. Now, go back to the not life. This is still a very small data set in terms of today's technology, but as I said, you know, it is very quite very, very fast. Now, the method has actually been implemented in some statistical packages, for example, Stata, which is very well known, common in economics. Datadesk, this is actually the program that I use now to illustrate the things. And also the package called R. How many of you heard of R? Just a little R, very good. So one, or even the provost heard of R. So one advantage of R is that it is free if you charge, you can download it legally from the internet. And if I have a minute, just to illustrate this using R program, and this will be basically the last slide that I have there. So if I go to R here, and I downloaded before I came here a data set that is the same data set that we looked at in the graph, rotating graph. Of course, the rotating graph is limited to three dimensions only. But if you have more than three dimensions, then you have to go numerical. And that's the program that is written in R by somebody else, not by me. And if you just say, click here and hit it there, this probably will take about 2 hours or so. But if I tell the computer, please, it will give it to me right away. So here is the result. What happens here if you go up there? It tells you what's happening here. Okay, all right. The following are the 101 outliers in the data. So this method, the numerical method, actually discovered one more outlier that you're supposed to have 100, but one of the true method points that are not outliers are close enough. If you look at the graph, you will discover. So again, this is here, and I just don't want to take more than this of your time. I would have illustrated with a much larger data set, but you know, if you don't believe me, try it for yourself. If we go back here, I have one more slide, as I mentioned, and this slide only to tell you that that you have made it. Thank you very much. I have made it.